regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Glad you're with me on the program today. Hopefully you had a good weekend. We've got some breaking news this morning. The Supreme Court granting cert to a second Second Amendment related case this term. Earlier the Supreme Court granted cert to the case Wolford versus Lopez, dealing with Hawaii's vampire rule that bars concealed carry from all private property unless it is posted that concealed carry is welcome. Today, the Supreme Court granting cert in a case called U.S. versus Hamani. This is a case dealing with Section 922G3, the federal prohibition on gun possession for unlawful users of drugs. Now, there are about five cases dealing with that same issue, that same statute, pending before the Supreme Court in conference. The court only granted cert to Hamani, just that single case. They will likely hold on to the others, but this is the vehicle that the court is going to use to address the issue about whether or not this statute is unconstitutional, either facially or as it applies to Mr. Hamani. And this is also the case, by the way, that DOJ was asking the government or asking the Supreme Court to take, because Mr. Hamani is probably the least sympathetic defendant out of the five. He is not charged simply with possessing a firearm while smoking marijuana once every so often, right? He is actually charged with being a drug dealer as well as an unlawful drug user. He was caught with both cocaine and marijuana and allegedly sold a drug, promethazine, I think it is. Also, according to Attorney General D. John Sauer, Hamani, and I'm quoting from the cert petition, is a dual citizen of the United States and Pakistan whose actions have drawn the attention of the Federal Bureau of Investigation. In 2019, a search of his phone at a border crossing revealed communications suggesting he was poised to commit fraud at the direction of suspected affiliates of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps. In 2020, he and his parents traveled to Iran to participate in a celebration of the life of Qasem Soleimani, an Iranian general and terrorist who had been killed by an American drone strike the month before. So again, not exactly a sympathetic defendant, right? Unlike somebody like Patrick Darnell Daniels, whose case was also pending before the Supreme Court. He was caught with guns and marijuana residue in his vehicle, told police that he used marijuana I think it was like 14 times a month, and was convicted of violating Section 922G3 and was sentenced to, I believe, 48 months in federal prison solely for smoking pot and possessing guns. Mr. Hamani, a little bit different. Now, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals in Hamani's case, just like they did with Patrick Darnell Daniels, said, listen, there is no national tradition of banning gun ownership for anybody who uses an intoxicating substance, whether it's lawful or unlawful. There may be a national tradition of banning people from possessing guns while they're intoxicated, but there is no national tradition of banning guns simply banning gun possession for simply using unlawful drugs. And so they reversed Mr. Hamani's conviction, which has led to the DOJ's appeal in this case. There is to my knowledge, a four-way circuit court split on the issue of Section 922G3. Whether or not it is constitutional on its face, whether or there needs to be some sort of individualized finding of dangerousness for somebody convicted under Section 922G3, whether there needs to be a finding of dangerous about a particular drug, the unlawful drug in question. So the court will have an opportunity to address this. But again, they're going to be addressing this issue through the lens of Ali Hamani's case, which is not great news for gun owners. I hope that the Supreme Court will consider the totality of this law. And again, I hope that they will at least bear in mind some of the other defendants that have come before them that are requesting relief from this same statute. Based on Rahimi, where the court did suggest that there needs to be an individualized finding of dangerousness in order to uphold somebody's prohibition on owning guns after a domestic violence restraining order, I think there's still an opportunity here for the court to use some common sense. I'll be honest, I don't think Section 922G3 is getting struck down in its entirety. I don't think a facial challenge is likely to succeed. I could be wrong about that. But my hope is at the very least, the Supreme Court will say, well, there can't just be this blanket prohibition, right? There really does. There's a difference between somebody who's using, let's say, PCP or somebody who is, you know, dealing drugs and somebody who is, you know, who's got a medical marijuana license, but was arrested and convicted because marijuana is still illegal under federal law. I hope that the court is going to be in a position to make that distinction. I suspect that it will, but we'll see. It's going to be a very interesting case before the Supreme Court. Now, on today's program, we're talking with Knox Williams from the American Suppressor Association. We actually spoke with Knox. I talked with Knox last Friday. And a couple of hours after we spoke, word broke that the ATF bringing back to work the examiners who are in charge of processing NFA applications. So that portion of the conversation that Knox and I had a little out of date, but he was hopeful that we would see that resolution. And in fact, it did come. So those examiners are back at work today. But we also talked with Knox about another Fifth Circuit case, this one dealing with the NFA restrictions on suppressors. And the position that has been taken by the assistant U.S. attorney in this case, which is Peterson versus U.S., that while suppressors are protected by the Second Amendment, the $200 tax and the registration requirements under the NFA are just modest burdens on our Second Amendment rights. But he also goes on to say that it would be different if we're talking about handguns. But we're not. We're talking about suppressors, a mere accessory, he says, not even though it's protected by the Second Amendment. And the Supreme Court has not established any sort of tiered level of protection for Second Amendment items. But that's essentially what the DOJ is asking the Supreme Court, right now asking the Fifth Circuit to do. Anyway, great conversation with Knox Williams, albeit a portion of it a little outdated, but outdated in a good respect. Take a look and a listen. Knox, thanks so much for coming on the program. It's good talking with you, sir.
Cam, it's a pleasure to be back, man.
Wish it was a better topic, but I mean, it is what it is. So let's get right into it here. In the Peterson case, for folks who are unaware, this is a case out of the Fifth Circuit involving a guy named George Peterson, who was charged with possessing an unregistered suppressor. He took a conditional guilty plea, but argued, I want to be able to argue my Second Amendment rights are being violated here. A district court judge says, no, they weren't. Three judge panel of the Fifth Circuit says, no, they weren't. So now Mr. Peterson is asking the Fifth Circuit to take this case en banc to review what's going on here. In the meantime, this case was filed during the Biden administration. But back in March, after the Trump administration had, you know, been sworn in, DOJ files a brief arguing that suppressors are not protected by the Second Amendment. A lot of objections from Second Amendment groups. They pull that brief back. They put in a new brief saying, okay, we reconsidered our position. Suppressors are protected by the Second Amendment, but the taxation registration requirement is still okay for this item that's protected by the Second Amendment because it's just a modest burden on Mr. Peterson and others who want to purchase suppressors. This is a position that they have reiterated in their latest brief, arguing that the Fifth Circuit should not take this case en banc. What is your reaction to the government's stance here in the Peterson case and towards the NFA, I should say, in general?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think that they've got a bad apple, right? I think AUSA Simpson clearly has no idea what he's talking about when it comes to the Second Amendment. We've seen that time and again. And I think that, you know, we saw that back earlier in the year when they actually rescinded one of their briefs and basically rewrote it. I think that that was a pretty clear sign that his views are not in line with the views of the administration. And we're hopeful that the administration will step in here again. But this guy, you know, is clearly the wrong guy for this particular job.
So based on his brief, and I don't have it right up in front of me, but I read it pretty extensively. You have it in front of you, so tell me if I get anything wrong here. His position, which, you know, like it or not, is the position of the Department of Justice at this point, is that, yes, suppressors are protected, but you can still tax them. You can still require them to be registered. And that doesn't mean that other Second Amendment protected items can be taxed and registered because suppressors are not fundamental to self-defense, right? They're an accessory, he says. And you know, I talked about this on Thursday's program, Knox. Like, I don't know where he's coming up with this idea that
It's like you can be sort of pregnant, right? Like either something's protected by the Second Amendment or it's not. And he's coming up with this weird tiered system of levels of protection where handguns are more protected by the Second Amendment than suppressors are. I mean, I've gone through Heller. I've gone through McDonald. I've gone through Catano. I've gone through Bruin. I've gone through Rahimi. I can't find anything in those cases that would indicate the Supreme Court has ever adopted or even suggested that this tiered system that the U.S. attorney is coming up with is accurate or relevant.
Yeah, I mean, that's because he's making it up, right? Like, this is a test that he has invented in his own head. And it's there's so many levels of irony here. First, him citing, you know, the way that he phrased it is NFA regulations at issue does not target ordinary firearms such as handguns, but only non-essential firearm accessories that are uniquely adaptable to criminal misuse. And like to pick out a few of those, right? First and foremost, handguns were included in the original draft of the National Firearms Act. So is he saying that had handguns been included, that somehow they would have failed his own strange test that he just created? Probably so. The other part is, you know, uniquely adaptable to criminal misuse. Well, we know that most criminals do not use suppressors because they're largely ineffective for the things that criminals would want them to. They make the gun less concealable and they're not actually silent. Whereas we know that handguns are involved in the overwhelming majority of crimes. Right. Like, so you're talking about the gun that is the most common tool used by criminals, and somehow something that even ATF, the federal government, has acknowledged is like, you know, it's so rarely used in crime that it's statistically insignificant. Right. Like, in what world is he coming up with this stuff? And I think really the core of it, though, is exactly what you said. You know, the Second Amendment applies equally to all items protected by the Second Amendment. There cannot be separate standards. That is just counterintuitive, and it flies in the face of the Constitution.
Yeah. You know, and getting back to what you said about, you know, this uniquely adaptable to criminal misuse, Mr. Peterson's attorneys have argued that the government's position would open the door to $200 or more, you know, taxes and registration requirements on handguns for exactly the reason that you said. And you know, this idea that, well, somehow this doesn't apply because, again, handguns are different somehow. You're right. It makes no sense whatsoever. The government contends that no, this wouldn't lead to a situation where that could happen, but they don't explain why, other than, again, this sort of, I would say it's a test, but it's not even really a test because Simpson doesn't even elaborate on what this test would be. As to, you know, where these layers of scrutiny or layers of protection would apply. It's just that they don't apply apparently to suppressors. They would apply to handguns. I mean, it is absolutely bizarre. But I do think it opens the door for anti-gun states to point to the government's language here and say, well, why can't we apply a $200 tax on all handgun purchases, right? We've also seen Democrats in Congress say we need to raise the NFA taxes, that, you know, $200 back in 1934 was a lot more than $200 is today. And that this, which, by the way, gets to this whole modest burden nonsense, right? This wasn't meant to be a modest burden. This was meant to be a substantial burden on the purchase of these NFA items. That's why it was a $200 tax at the time. And it's why Democrats would say, well, let's raise it to $5,000, $6,000 today. So, you know, even if this is not, and I would argue that a $200 tax is, in fact, a substantial burden today for many Americans who are certainly living paycheck to paycheck. I don't want to add $200 to the cost of any of my purchases. It strikes me that this is opening the door for a lot of gun control groups and anti-gun politicians to take this position and run with it.
Yeah, 100%. And like, let's frame this in a broader context. What would groups like the ACLU say if an acting U.S. attorney were to put out a briefing to a federal court that said, hey, imposing a $200 tax on the poll, allowing people to vote, is just a modest burden that people can do, right? Like, it's nonsense. It's ludicrous. Honestly, I think AUSA Simpson is establishing dangerous precedent. We need the DOJ to come in and kind of slap his wrist again, right? I think that he's acting like a petulant child who put out his own personal opinion, even though it disagrees, and is incongruent with the administration's position. That got slapped down. He got his wrist slapped. He came back and kind of ground his teeth and put it out where it was, yes, suppressors are protected by the Second Amendment, but the NFA is still okay. And I think he came back this round, you know, hoping to capitalize on the fact that during the government shutdown, many of the people at the White House who review all of the filings that go through are being furloughed, right? So they're grossly understaffed because of the government shutdown at the moment. So like, what a great time to push this through. And I you know, that's supposition. I've got nothing to back that claim up other than the fact that I know that a lot of the people that review these cases are not at work right now because of the shutdown. And this guy's flip-flopping. You know, he's talking out of both sides of his mouth. I think that he's smart enough to know that. And it's much to the detriment of the Second Amendment and the citizens in the Fifth Circuit.
Well, we know the DOJ, at least some individuals of the DOJ, are paying attention to what Second Amendment groups are saying. We've seen Harvey Dillon, the Assistant Attorney General, who's in charge of the Civil Rights Division, has done a great job of explaining the DOJ's position on some of these things. She put out a video. This is going to air on Monday. So last week, she put out a video kind of talking about where the DOJ has come down on some of these things. Specifically on NFA, there was a case she talked about that's at the Supreme Court, at least pending before the Supreme Court's review, Rush versus United States. That deals with short-barreled rifles. And the government has taken the position that not only is there no circuit court split, so the Supreme Court shouldn't take this case, but this is the Solicitor General now arguing that restrictions on SBRs are within the national tradition of firearms ownership in this country. Again, taking the position that these taxes and registration requirements in general are actually a part of the national tradition of firearms ownership or arms ownership. He referenced, you know, special taxes on Bowie knives and things like that. So I'd like to think that this is just, you know, an acting assistant U.S. attorney going off half-cocked, but I got to tell you, Knox, I'm not convinced that that's the case. I mean, we've seen in other NFA-related lawsuits that the government's position is the NFA is fine. The NFA comports with the national tradition of firearms ownership and that the Supreme Court should not take any NFA cases right now because there's no circuit court split. But neither is the DOJ arguing in a position that would create a circuit court split.
Yeah. Yeah. No. And it's a frustrating place to be for gun owners, right? Like,
yeah,
you know, I think that, you know, on one level, we've got to acknowledge Rome wasn't built in a day, right? Like they have taken more concrete steps than any administration ever has.
Yeah.
Even just merely acknowledging that suppressors are protected by the Second Amendment, that was a monumental step forward. It was certainly not everything that we want. And that's why we're working hard to try and make sure that they're armed with the right facts, that their perspective is rooted in reality, not just in, you know, well, this is just how it's been, therefore that's how it should be. So, you know, we've obviously got a lot of work to do to try and, you know, bring the truth to the administration, and they're going to take it and do with it what they will. But nonetheless, you know, I don't think that we're in a position right now to throw the baby out with the bathwater. You know, yes, you're absolutely correct. There are some things that we vehemently disagree with them on. And, you know, right now are actively trying to win them over to the truth.
Yeah. Well, I mean, listen, my position has been, and it continues to be, this is the most pro Second Amendment DOJ in modern history. And there is more work to be done. I mean, I think both of those statements can be true, right? So not to mitigate or denigrate or downplay any of the work that the DOJ is doing. I mean, again, this is the first time in history we've seen the Civil Rights Division deployed to defend our right to keep and bear arms in lawsuits against the LA Sheriff's Department, advocating against Illinois' ban on, you know, so-called assault weapons and large capacity magazines. Those are historic steps. And those should be acknowledged, right? Those are really important things. But it also, as you say, this too is important, right? And there is still some work to be done. So hopefully the folks at the DOJ are listening. Hopefully they are considering again both the short-term and the long-term consequences of adopting the position that the assistant U.S. attorney has taken in Louisiana.
Yeah.
And the damage that could be done, not just to our ability to purchase and possess NFA items, but again, you know, commonly owned handguns, commonly owned rifles, shotguns, whatever you want to say. I mean, this position articulated by Simpson, whether he likes it or not, cannot just apply to suppressors. Yep. If that's his position on the Second Amendment, that Second Amendment protected items can be taxed and registered, that applies to all Second Amendment protected items.
100%. Yeah, no, it really does. And I think it's another added irony here that this is all coming out during the government shutdown, mm-hmm. you know, where NFA examiners since October 1st, at least the time of recording, have been out of work completely. That means no new suppressors have been manufactured. No new suppressors have been transferred from manufacturer, distributor, dealer, and certainly none have been sold to consumers because every single step of the way is controlled by the ATF, by statute. Every single step of the way requires that modest burden of a registry, right? So, you know, here we are 17 days later at time of recording, not a single suppressor has been sold, not a single suppressor has been made or transferred. That, to me, is a glaring abuse of the Second Amendment.
You know, and I want to talk about that for a second because, you know, again, we're dealing with a government shutdown. We don't know how long this is going to last, when it's going to end. So the idea of filing a lawsuit, I mean, you know, the government has 30 days to respond to a lawsuit, right? So it's tough to try to litigate this issue. But in theory, I mean, if the government is taking the position that Second Amendment, that suppressors are protected by the Second Amendment, and yet it is impossible for somebody to legally acquire a suppressor at this point in time, it seems to me like you could make the argument that the government is violating our Second Amendment rights by not allowing us to not continuing this system by which we can purchase a suppressor.
Yep. Yeah. No, look, so if our organization had Bloomberg money, you know, tens of millions of dollars, and just, you know, had dollars to throw at anything that we wanted, we would have absolutely filed a lawsuit on the first day. You know, we're kind of scraping pennies together on the four lawsuits that we're funding right now. So it's sort of a prioritization thing, but we have been very actively working and engaged with ATF, with DOJ, with OMB, the Office of Management and Budget, and with the White House to try and bring the examiners back to work. And that's exactly the case that we've been making. Look, this is infringing the Second Amendment rights of all law-abiding Americans who want to purchase these things and have the constitutional right to do so. It's also bad practice for ATF, right? Especially leading into January 1, when that tax is going to go away, there's going to be a massive spike in demand. And they don't need to be going into that with a huge backlog created by this government shutdown, right? That's just going to cause wait times to skyrocket. And it's such an avoidable thing. It's also true that there's been established precedent of bringing folks back to work who process applications for constitutionally protected rights, right? Look at the First Amendment and people applying to protest. They brought those folks back in the Biden administration, you know, after about a week of a shutdown. So that precedent is there. Second Amendment is just as big a constitutional right as the First Amendment. And you look at the folks at the FBI Nix Center. They never left. They were considered accepted or colloquially essential personnel the whole time. And that's really all that we're asking is, hey, these folks are processing Second Amendment applications as well, which is a ludicrous, you know, idea in and of itself. But that's a fight for another day. These folks need to be back in the office. They never need to leave. And we're very optimistic that, you know, either by time of airing or shortly thereafter, those folks are going to be back in the office.
All right. Well, keep us updated on that front too, Knox, because you're right. This is, you know, that is, you know, even beyond this lawsuit and the position of the assistant U.S. attorney. Yeah. Right now it's kind of moot because it's impossible to legally get a suppressor at the moment anyway. Yep. Listen, I always appreciate you coming on the program. I really enjoy talking with you, even when the conversation is not what we want it to be. But I hope the next time we have you on, we'll have some good news to report.
Heck yeah, man. Well, I look forward to it, and it's always a pleasure chatting with you, Cam.
Thanks, Knox. We'll talk again soon.
Sounds good.
My thanks to Knox for joining us on the program. Glad to see him here, and hopefully he'll be back again soon. And I know we are all glad to see the ATF. How weird does it sound to say we're glad to see ATF employees back on the job? But again, when we're talking about the folks who are in charge of processing NFA applications, yes, it is better to have them at work than have them sitting at home. All right, on to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day, and our recidivist report out of Chicago. The website CWB Chicago reporting, man gets 4 years for, quote, extremely dangerous robberies aboard CTA trains. CTA trains, by the way, that are gun-free zones. So it is impossible for you to legally defend yourself with a firearm on Chicago Transit Authority property, both because of CTA rules and because of the law in Illinois that bans concealed carry on all public transportation. Lots of violent crimes, in these locations, but again, no ability for you to legally protect yourself with a firearm. Now, in this case, Breon Edwards and his accomplices not alleged to have used a firearm. Instead, they used their fists and their feet to assault two individuals. This was back on September 16th of last year, about 3:30 that morning. They allegedly targeted a 20-year-old man on a CTA platform, and then about 3 hours later, they robbed a 22-year-old man aboard a train. Police said one accomplice kicked and punched the first victim. Another strangled the second, who actually required hospitalization. A 14-year-old charged along with the 21-year-old Edwards in connection with these robberies. A supervisor with the Chicago Police says Edwards also suspected of involvement in another robbery on the Red Line in November of last year, though he was not charged in that case. So what makes this a recidivist report? Well, according to CWB Chicago, at the time of these robberies, Edwards was on probation for two previous burglary convictions. Yeah. The judge has now terminated that probation, deeming it unsatisfactory at sentencing. And Edwards, again, sentenced to four-year terms for these robberies. They'll be served concurrently at the same time. And he is expected to do basically 2 years for these robberies. So 1 year for each violent assault of a patron of the Chicago Transit Authority. And again, if you, even if you possess a valid concealed carry license in Illinois, you could be criminally charged for having that firearm on CTA property to defend yourself against individuals like Breon Edwards and his accomplices, which is a problem. There is a case, Schoenthal versus Raul, that deals with this prohibition. A district court judge granted relief to the four individual plaintiffs in that case, ruling that the law was unconstitutional, at least as it applied to them. That ruling, however, was overturned by the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, which held that, oh, no, these gun-free zones are perfectly fine because we're talking about, you know, people in crowded metal tubes that the founders could never have envisioned. So even though there is no national tradition of banning firearms on public transportation, the Seventh Circuit says it's perfectly okay. That case was decided a few weeks ago. The plaintiffs in that case, I believe, have 60 days to appeal to the Supreme Court. We still have several weeks left for them to file that appeal. I do expect we will see a cert petition filed in Schoenthal versus Raul. And hopefully this is an issue that the Supreme Court will take up, because again, there are millions of people across this country who rely on public transportation to get around, and to tell them you can't carry when you set foot on a subway, you can't carry when you set foot on a bus, deprives them of their right to bear arms, not just in those locations, which again are not immune to crime, but it deprives them of their ability to exercise the right to bear arms throughout the entirety of their day. They can't carry before they get on that public transportation. They can't carry after they get on that public transportation if they can't carry while they are on public transportation. And to me, that is a huge issue. And these gun-free zones need to disappear. All right, on to today's Armed Citizen story. Boy, this is a weird one out of Florida. As the Fox News reports, a McDonald's worker shoots customer in neck during, quote, McMess altercation, Florida sheriff says. Yeah, Sheriff Grady Judd had a lot of fun talking about this case, really got into the Mick component of this McMess. Involved an employee of McDonald's, as well as two customers who apparently were incensed that their order was taking too long. So I believe this was last weekend or over the weekend. At this McDonald's in Polk County, the store employees were just overwhelmed with online orders. This was early Sunday morning, last Sunday, not yesterday, but a week ago yesterday. And, you know, they're busy, right? So they're trying to take care of all these online orders. A couple of guys pull in through the drive-through, Nicholas Jones, age 18, 20-year-old Peter Story, and a worker named Juan Soto, who's 21. Basically said, hey, look, we're sorry, we're way behind. Our online orders are overwhelming us. He said, we can't take your orders right now. because we just can't get to them in a timely manner. According to Judd, that's when the pair started threatening Soto, saying, well, we're going to hang out here. When you get off, we're going to beat you up. Because they can't get their Big Mac, I guess. As Sheriff Judd said, they threatened to attack the man who just told him, we're busy, we can't take any more orders. And he did that because the manager told him to. They threatened him with violence. Soto told the man he didn't get off work till 4 a.m. and then he went back to work. The sheriff says that they continued to threaten Soto. He said they're having a McArgument in the McDonald's over McHamburgers or a lack of McHamburgers. He also said that either Story or Jones allegedly said that they had a switch, a 30 clip, to which Soto replied he also had a gun. At that point, Judd says the manager stepped in between the three to stop the, quote, McRabble. Like I said, Sheriff Judd really getting into the fast food aspect of this self-defense story. He said, so they continue to threaten a mass shooting because their customer's there with their firearms. Adding that Soto went to get his gun and then threatened Jones and Story with it in the main part of the store. The manager of the McDonald's told Story and Jones to leave because they were trespassing. Jones said only law enforcement can declare that he's trespassing. The sheriff said, well, that's not the case. And he said as the two men tried to grab Soto's gun, Soto pulled the trigger, shot Story in the neck. Sheriff Judd said it's a blessing. It was a very minor wound. He said, but you know what? When you start shooting McGuns, you'll get people's attention and they'll let you McHave the restaurant. And that's what they did. Jones then drove Story to a hospital and called the police. According to Fox News, Soto fled the scene, but was called back to the restaurant when deputies arrived, saying that Soto cooperated, but he's been charged with felony tampering with evidence. He's not been charged with shooting his assailants, but he is facing criminal charges for something related to the shooting. Again, tampering with evidence at some point. Sheriff Judd says, listen, folks, it's never okay to threaten a mass shooting. It's never okay to threaten to beat people up at a business. And it's never okay to grab your ammunition and your firearm and run after a shooting. If that's the only thing that Soto is charged with, leaving the scene with his firearm and ammunition, I can understand. These two individuals are still there, at least at the moment, right? Now, eventually they left and the guy who was shot was driven to the hospital. But I can understand Soto wanting to get away from that situation at that moment. And the fact that he came back and is cooperating with police, to me, undercuts the charges of tampering with evidence. I hope that the state's attorney here, if that's the entire reason why he's being charged with a felony, I hope the state's attorney uses some common sense and drops the charges. If Mr. Soto was acting in self-defense, and again, just left because he was freaked out, he didn't want to continue to present himself as a target to individuals or their accomplices. Again, I mean, you know, they might have buddies that would show up to harm Mr. Soto. Was it legally the right thing to do? Probably not. Was it an understandable decision? I think so. And again, the fact that he apparently did come back, was cooperating with police, that to me is a mitigating factor here. In a tampered evidence charge. So I hope that common sense prevails. The sheriff did admit that Soto had a right to stand his ground and protect himself. He said these guys are threatening to do violence after they've already threatened on the outside of the store and came inside. He said they created a well-founded fear in him and the store manager. It was just a McMess. He said, but we'll sort it out because we're McGood at investigating McCrime. Yeah, again, really got into the McDonald's aspect of the self-defense story. But again, if the sheriff acknowledges that he was acting in lawful self-defense, that he had a well-founded fear of harm, again, I think that you've got to make some allowance for this armed citizen who acted in self-defense to extricate himself from that situation where he may very well have still believed that he was at risk of physical harm. So we'll keep our eyes open for any more details, but hopefully, again, the state attorney there in Florida will use some common sense and will drop the felony charges against Mr. Soto. Unless there's, again, something that we don't know that would implicate him further here. All right, on to today's good deed of the day. Let's go back to Chicago here. The Chicago Sun-Times with the headline, "Woman assaulted in loop is grateful to Good Samaritan for scaring off attacker." And this was a case of being in the right place at the right time and willing and able to do the right thing. Sierra Ruggiero was walking home. She's about 10 minutes away from where she lives. This was last Wednesday night. She said a guy on a bicycle pushes her onto a busy street and then tried to sexually assault her. She had just left the Blue Line station near her home. So again, I don't think Ruggiero is a gun owner, but even if she was, she would not have been allowed to carry a firearm on her way home because she uses public transportation. So she's walking down the street and a man on a bicycle again pushes her over a short railing and into traffic and then tried to sexually assault her right there in public. A woman named Alex Taylor saw what was going on. She yells at the guy to stop. And apparently that was enough. That intervention, just, hey, I see what you're doing. Stop. Get off of her. Was enough for the guy to get back on his bicycle and then pedal away into the darkness. Ruggiero said, once he ran away, she came up to me. She checked to see if I was okay. She was the kindest soul. Saying that Alex Taylor stayed with her at the scene as paramedics assessed her until police gave her a ride home. Alex Taylor said the man had almost knocked her over when he sped by her on the bike just a few seconds earlier. She said, I felt so bad for her, talking about Ruggiero, saying it was awful just to see. But I felt awful that she experienced that, so I felt like I had to stay with her because I didn't want her to be alone because she was really upset. So I gave her a little hug, and we just breathed together. We talked about it a little bit. Ruggiero suffered some bruises to her legs and her tailbone. She said, I don't think I'll ever fully mentally recover from this. She said, you know, there will be moments where I can definitely forget about it in the future, but it's something that's always going to live with me. And she said, honestly, it's definitely changed my perspective of just how I operate in the city going forward. She said that she moved to Chicago from Florida about 2 years ago. Said she's already hypervigilant about walking in the city. She said she keeps her phone in a pocket. She doesn't wear headphones. She has a tight grip, she says, on a 40-ounce stainless steel water bottle that she carries not only to hydrate herself, but to use as a self-defense weapon. But she said the water bottle was knocked out of her hand. And she said, you know, no matter how safe you are, how protected you think you are, something can happen. She said the experience may compel her to carry pepper spray or, quote, another self-defense tool, according to the Chicago Sun-Times. I don't even know that pepper spray is allowed on CTA property, honestly. I think not only is it a gun-free zone, I think it's a weapons-free zone. So, again, if Ruggiero is reliant on public transportation to get around, that water bottle may be the only thing that she can carry for self-defense, at least legally. But is that right? Does that make sense? Not from my perspective. When you've got individuals who are acting with impunity in Chicago, and clearly there are a lot of criminals who are doing just that, even leaving the constitutional considerations aside, citizens should have the ability to protect themselves. And when you add in the fact that the city of Chicago, the Chicago Transit Authority, and the state of Illinois are depriving people of a fundamental civil right by making all public transportation gun-free zones, off-limits to lawful concealed carry, that's not just a common sense problem. That is a constitutional problem because there is no national tradition of barring gun ownership in those circumstances. The Supreme Court has said explicitly, you can't just ban guns from every crowded space that's generally protected by police, like the island of Manhattan. Well, public transportation in Chicago may be a crowded public space that is generally protected by police, but you don't have to go through magnetometers before you get on a train in Chicago. There are no armed guards stationed at every public bus or on every public bus. No. It is, again, is exactly what the Supreme Court said. You cannot declare a gun-free zone, a crowded public space that is generally protected by police. There's nothing particularly sensitive about public transportation, and certainly it is seen as a playground for predators. And even once you get off CTA property, as we've seen in this particular case, you are vulnerable because you've been disarmed on CTA property. So, again, get back to Schoenthal versus Raul, and hopefully a majority of Supreme Court justices willing to hear that case when it reaches their doorstep. All right, that is going to do it for this edition of Bearing Arms, Cam & Company. I do want to thank you for being a part of the program. Looking forward to seeing you back here again tomorrow. We're going to be talking about what's going on in the Virgin Islands, the U.S. Virgin Islands, where there is this massive gun control bill. It's a semi-auto ban. It's a magazine ban. It requires the owners of these firearms to either modify them to comply with Virgin Island law, turn them over to police for destruction, or get rid of their firearms with no compensation provided. It also increases the training mandates to simply possess a firearm in the home. This is a very controversial bill. There was supposed to be a hearing last week, but the author of this bill basically pulled the legislation, says it's going through a major rewrite. Kosi Ono, who is the head of a new group for gun owners in the U.S. Virgin Islands, has been vocally opposed to this. He's also been involved in litigation, by the way, involving permits in the U.S. Virgin Islands. Anyway, Mr. Ono is going to join us on the program. We're going to talk about this. If this bill passes, it would be, I think it would be the most onerous and restrictive so-called assault weapons ban in the United States and its territories, hands down, because again, it would require people to get rid of their firearms. Nobody's grandfathered in. If you've got these guns that are now banned, you got to do something with them. You can't keep them. So we'll talk with Mr. Ono about this, about the potential changes, whether or not this bill is fixable in any way, shape, or form. But looking forward to that conversation again coming up on tomorrow's Bearing Arms, Cam & Company. Have a great rest of your day today. We'll see you back here tomorrow. Be sure to check out BearingArms.com, though, throughout the day today. We're keeping you up to date on all of the latest Second Amendment information from all across the nation. Litigation, legislation, regulation, the culture war attack on gun ownership, it is all there for you. If you like what you see, I would encourage you to become a VIP, VIP Gold, or VIP Platinum member. While the government shutdown is underway, the ATF workers are back there, at least processing NFA items, but you can still get a great deal on VIP memberships. Use the promo code POTUS47 and get 74% off your VIP membership. That is a great deal, but it only lasts as long as the shutdown continues. So take advantage of it now. All right, we will see you back here tomorrow. Until then, be well, be safe, and be free.